Bob Randall is a storyteller and a songwriter and a traditional owner of the lands around Uluru in central Australia. His early childhood was spent in the shadow of the rock, and his extended family introduced him into the traditional way of life for desert people. Now, many people would see the desert as a harsh and unforgiving place, but Bob Randall was brought up to see it as a place which tells you where you can find the things you need to live. And so for him and his people, it's natural to see the desert as a kind of a mother, a place that sustains you with its generous spirit. But Bob Randall was taken away from his family when he was just a kid, and so he grew to adulthood in Arnhem Land, in saltwater country. He later became famous with his song Brown Skin Baby, which brought national and international attention to the stories of children who were separated from their parents. And more recently, he was the narrator of a documentary called Kanyini. I spoke with Bob Randall back in 2006, and I began by asking him what he could remember as a kid being brought up in the traditional life in Central Australia.
I remember the sense of freedom and having that responsibility caring for yourself, even at that really early age. The people are teaching you to be responsible for yourself. They're teaching you how to find foods if you happen to stray and be away from the family. You know, you carry those skills with you. You can track the lizards or the marsupials, know how to get the maku or widgety grub. There's definite association of all the food sources with other things. So you learn all of those secret signs to know where to look. See, not every tree has a widgety grub or maku in their root system, only one. And you've got to identify that one tree from all the others who are very similar.
And what age do you learn this, Bob?
You learn this about the age of four upwards. And you can start doing this caring for self. You start saying, oh, the tree cares for me. It's giving me this food. You know, you have a relationship of receiving something good from something other than your human mother. Then the tree, in a sense, to that child, is another mother. You can't be lonely when you're living in that environment full of family members from the ground up, in the ground you're walking on. The grass and trees you're with, you know, and the insects you're with.
And of course, the land's a dangerous place too, and you can get into all sorts of trouble there. What kind of a view do you have of the land when it's not helpful to you?
Well, if you do the wrong thing, even your uncles and aunties will discipline you. Not your parents, remember?
Not your parents?
No, parents not allowed. Your mother and father do, our mother and father in Anangu tradition, is not allowed to discipline a child in any form with hard eyes, which is you scowl at the kid for doing the wrong thing, with loud voices, and definitely it's a criminal offence to slap a child by a mother and father. You can get into serious trouble if you start doing that in the presence of other members of the family. That's why parents aren't allowed to teach, really. It might make them impatient or angry with their words or with their eyes. And it's the subtleties of Anangu ways, Aboriginal ways, that I found so appealing to me. Right up to the age of what we call the learning, which is where it comes about 12 when the first ceremonies that kids are introduced to. This is my area. Where the totemic names are given and the paintings are done and you start being associated with your other members of your male family to start learning together. And right up to that time, it's the parents that are caring for you. Slowly as you get older and you start to be taught, then your uncles and aunties take over and grandparents. And grandparents are great teachers because they do it through amazing love and bribery.
Love and bribery.
Oh, wow, very well done.
It's all carrot and no stick.
Very good at it, and they teach you so much by using that system of rewarding you. It leads you to then the more serious ceremonies where you start detailed knowledge of survival, where the waterways are, where water can be found in the drought, and what animals can be found where by the contours of one's country. And they're associated. You don't look for honey ant underneath gum trees. You've got to go to the older wattle trees to find honey ant. You can't go to any tree and expect to find a widget to grow in the root system. You only got to go to this one particular tree because that's the only place it is.
Bob, you grew up around Uluru. What did the rock mean to you?
Well, my parents came from the rock. I didn't grow up there as a child. I went back there in the late '60s when I was looking for my family, after trying to find them, because everybody was shifted out quite early. Where I grew up was a station about 150 k's from Uluru to the east, and the people would always tell you about this place where they'd come from and which you're responsible for. You know, they'd always give you that too. If you have the opportunity, you must learn the songs and ceremonies associated with the what we would say a spiritual caring for country and being responsible for is to sing the right song for the many sites that's in those areas when you're there, so that you acknowledge the closeness of you for your family and the country you're standing on. You know, the Tjukurpa trails or song lines or story tracks are crisscrossing this country everywhere. And they're the kind of things your grandparents pass on to you, and then your uncles teaches you more strongly, and probably the aunties would teach the girls. So we still have a very strong gender rule applies at where I am amongst us. You know, the men teach the boys and the women teach the girls.
Bob, tell me what it is, what it means to you, Kanyeni.
I'd say the closest I can say in the English is unconditional love with responsibility. That's what it means to me. Caring without no limitations. And that's the way our Anangu parents raised us. We could do anything, and yet you could do no wrong in their eyes. They teach you with songs, dances and painting, and with lots of tickling, you know, as a child, so that you're forever laughing. You're in the arms of many mothers and many fathers as a child growing up in that system. You're never without a parent. I had no idea which individual woman was my mother until I grew up.
You had no idea?
None whatsoever. Then they said, no, this is your mother, that one Tangawa. That's the one that gave you birth. All those other mothers are your close carers.
Bob, you talk a bit about what it's like to actually live almost naked, sleeping on the earth. Mm. At night, you lie there and you look up at the stars, and you know, the ancient Greeks looked up there and thought they saw the outlines of the gods that were kind of indifferent or interested in what they did, and scientists look up and look at the stars and they see balls of gas light years away. What did you look up and see?
Your ceiling in your room. And it was all there for you. You know, and you're sleeping with the sacred ones, your own parents, you know, your fathers and mothers. And, of course, the Earth Mother is always there because it gives you everything you need to have. And in those days when you're totally know of no shops around the next corner or anyone else to bring you food if you need it, I tell you that Earth becomes your mother. Very in a realistic sense. It kind of supplies you with anything you want, and the skills that are taught you to be able to identify that comes from your parents and your uncles and aunties and grandparents and each other. You know, the older sisters and brothers would teach the younger ones as well. It was that closeness that I found so valuable.
In the film, you say that in the time when Jesus walked the earth, you know, my people were here, living in the moment, and you put a lot of stress on living in the moment. Mm. Why? What's the stress on that mean?
The important time of each one of our lives, yours as well as mine, is now. Because if you say the wrong thing or you do the wrong in this moment, there's not a thing you can do to make it right tomorrow. So you have to make sure that you are doing the right thing as you understand rightness, not anyone else's judgment of rightness. Now, I'm here now. Tomorrow it doesn't matter. I may not be. I might be elsewhere. And if I do it and it's past, I'm going to carry the sadness with me, and I don't want that.
Does that mean enjoying the moments too?
It's meant to be enjoyed. That's why you do the right thing by yourself. And when you do right things for others, you can't help but live right. So when you do the wrong thing, it becomes a baggage and you'll keep on doing wrong things. And it's not a very good way to live.
Well, the way you describe your childhood, it sounds like you were very happy. Was it as idyllic as I'm saying here, or did it have its ups and downs? I mean, it's still human life, and things go wrong. And
I think you had the little the naggies in it, but it wasn't many, you know, because you remember what's the major part of one's life. And when I think back to my childhood, we were pretty well looked after. Right up till I was seven, I was living in the bush with my family, so I've got a pretty good memory of a pretty good time of living and a happy time of living, because I was always with family. And it was the importance of the family that was, taught very strongly. All of us in our area, us desert people, even though we may belong to three or four different nations, we all got that relationship system that let us apply kinship terms to each other. Even today.
At seven, life changed completely for you. Tell me what happened.
Drastically. I went back to that site with the family, and they said, this is where he came and stole you from. We were taken into Alice Springs by Constable Bill McKinnon behind his camel, and the aunties, they held your hand, and they had the chains round their neck, and they walked behind the camels right into Alice Springs jail. And then we were put off at the bungalow by Constable Bill McKinnon. I think from what I can recall, there's probably about three or four of us kids was taken at that time.
Taken from your families?
Yeah, from the Angusdown property area and Middleton Pond.
And what happened then, Bob?
Well, I was institutionalised, and the new way of being, I was introduced to, like, living in a house that didn't give you no sense of the wind or the climate change or the sounds of birds and insects. All that was just blocked. And the stiffly and almost a feeling that you were being choked, but you didn't have the space around you. You couldn't see the stars. You couldn't see the trees. And you was made to sleep in a bed. You know, with foreign material covering you. You know, when I was raised, just sleeping beside my parents and having the warmth of their body near me and close to me on the sand. And if it was cold, whatever things you could keep warm with you used, but usually you slept close to the fire. And when I went back later, they showed me the many places we used to camp as children. Because my mother's worked for old Bill Little, looking after his sheep, so we used to camp all over the property. And then this is where I was introduced to wearing clothes, and I found that was terribly uncomfortable. And forever, and these were verified by my older family members in Bangla, you was forever getting rid of your clothes and burying them. And we'd make you take us to where you buried them and make you dig it up and put it back on you. And then they got cunning. They tied it onto me so tight that I had to get used to it. So it was a traumatic time, that time of adjustment. And the other thing which was unfortunate, we weren't allowed to speak our language. And that's all you knew at 7 years of age.
Did you lose your language then?
You had to. You wasn't allowed to speak it. Every time you spoke it in the presence of the teacher, and you didn't know any other way of communicating. You was yelled at, slapped if you did it too often, until you stopped talking it.
I can only imagine what your family must have been going through as well, your parents and your uncles and aunties. Do you know what happened to them, and what was their response? They'd lost their children.
Yeah, they were rounded up too and shifted. Most of them was taken from Angusdown to Arayonga with another ration depot that was set up, you know, where they could distribute food from. And that's where my mother ended up dying. My father ended up living and dying there as well. And eventually when I went and looking for my family, I was just introduced to their graves.
Why were you cleared from the land?
I got no idea. That's the $100 question, because honestly, they could have looked after us where we were quite well. We wonder, but maybe someone else can answer that question.
The feeling was that it was good for you at the time.
Yeah.
You were being civilised. Was that the feeling?
Yeah, that's right. That's the general purpose of it all, yeah.
You were sent to a receiving home for Indigenous children in Alice Springs, then to the Croker Island Reservation in Arnhem Land, which the country's completely different there.
Totally saltwater culture.
Huge snakes, crocs.
Yes.
Not much of that around Central Australia. What was that like for you, Bob?
As I said, when you got used to the people again, once again, you as in an institution, your every movement was controlled and determined by the authorities. But these were people who, in the best way they could, cared for you in their way, you know, as Christian missionaries. But when you got to know the older people, Anangu people, or Aboriginal people there, they started fitting us kids into their family system. And it was the same as ours. But in an adoption way, as we'd say, in a white system, but we found that we ended up with uncles and aunties, fathers and mothers, grandparents, brothers and sisters, amongst the coastal people, and each of them would grow us up. I was taught as a boy about how to live in saltwater country, how to work with crocodiles, and I became a very successful crocodile hunter from being taught well by who I called Uncle Mick Yarmid.
Nonetheless, you're living a different lifestyle. You're learning to speak English. You're losing your old language.
My way is always living in the moment. So whatever's you in, that's the one you take on for your own survival and attitude of being satisfied with life. If you keep pining for something and you don't take on where you are in the moment, you could quite often miss some valuable lesson. You know, if a kid is being taught this bush duck only comes in at a certain time and this is the way you find it and this is the time you can eat it, this is the way you go about preparing it, you're missing out on some good lessons because you're thinking of how it used to be.
I suppose what I'm asking, Bob, is that, you know, living as a young child in Central Australia, you're living in a land which I suppose to you is like a cathedral, and you leave that behind. Do you stop being Aboriginal?
No, you just move into another man's country, and then you know you're not on your land. And then you hope that the people whose country you're on will care for you, as well as the country you're meeting for the first time will care for you like your own country has throughout your childhood. And it usually does. And once you come into that relationship system, once the people start calling you my son, then you kind of feel the earth there is saying my son. And you find that even when you start wanting things, it's there. Once you learn through your uncles, new adopted uncles and aunties, what signs to look for.
What do you look for?
Well, plant is one of the greatest teachers are the tree, especially when you're looking for water and all you got in front of you is an ocean. But you want drinking water. And what you look for, you know, this is what the old people tell you. Now look for this special grass. And it's usually associated with the pandanus tree and the casuarina in hollowed out places. And if you find this grass, that's where you dig in. Not any grass, but this grass. Even though I was on another people's country, I was able to listen to that country.
And when you have that information given to you by your new uncles and aunties, and you find that water in the plant, what is the earth then telling you?
Drink, it's yours, my son. You see? It's once again giving, and that's the way one thing I remember about most of our people was the generosity they had. The ones in Arnhem Land just took me in as their child and grew me up. And it didn't take me long to learn and listen to their country, who was also adopting me and teaching me things.
When did music begin for you?
Quite early, yeah. It was a guy used to come out, Herbie Lawton, on a boat and with a guitar, and he sung for us on Croker Island. We said, wow, he's just singing these old songs we're listening to on my wind-up gramophone, you know. And he was singing, and we looked at his guitar, and we handled it, and the elder boys then made five big guitars. We had homemade guitars. Yeah, from those bulk tea leaves that used to be sent out in tea chests.
Yes.
And this glue was pinched from the carpenter shop. Yeah, and they put it all together as their mind could remember, you know, and then the handle was made out of kapok. And milkwood was the little winder. And the strings, the fret strings, were set with the wire round cartons
right.
of tin goods and others. And the music strings was taken from a crashed American Liberator at the northern end of the island. You know, the steering...
What aircraft? Crash bit of aircraft from the Second World War, you mean?
Yeah. One crashed up there, and we picked the guitar strings out of that crashed aeroplane. There was five guitars made, so everybody learned to play it.
Well, you know, the land will provide me with guitar strings if I wait long enough, and it did.
Even if it came from America.
Well, you started singing, and your songs were often the first people knew about children being removed from their families.
Yes, I heard. The ABC research officer, he came and he asked me, are they true? I said, yeah. He said, how come we don't know? I said, I don't know, but we know. It's me. I'm singing about me and the people who are with me. The experiences we've had, you know, and he looked into it. He researched it really well, and he realised it was government policy. That's why it's so important, you know. To government is responsible for doing that at a high and deep political level, and I think that's why we're saying you've got to acknowledge that so that we can all move forward. Don't bury it under which you can't. It's affecting all of us today, our children, our grandchildren, and eventually our great-grandchildren. You know, and that's the seriousness of these things. If they're not dealt with, they get worse, and depends what generation listens to it and their interpretation of what happened. It either affects them angrily or an attitude of acceptance. Oh, let things be as they are. You know, a lot of our people accepted that. We say felt they were so powerless to do anything. Others didn't like it one bit. But I had to get rid of my anger, and I did it through singing those many songs I sing about those experiences.
You never saw your own mother again, did you?
No, just her grave. The family introduced me to her grave at Arionga, Otu, as it's known. And that's outside of our country. It's really in the Western Aranda country where our people were taken from Angustan, Walra and Uluru and that area there, you know.
What was it like for you to return to your country after being away for so long?
Anticipating joy of meeting up with your family was always there, and for some reason I just assumed my mother was still there. I never for a minute thought she may be dead. And then when it hit me, I just broke down, that's all. It was very sad when I heard the message, but my nieces were there, my uncles were there, other family members were there, a couple of brothers were still alive, mum's, and we all just cried together. And then some of them took me to the cemetery grave, and they just let me sit with Mum at her graveside, and they stood a little bit away from where I was.
Did you talk to them?
Yeah. Yeah. I still do. All the time.
Bob, what was it like to return to the country too, to the land that you'd been away from?
Reconnecting was really an amazing experience, especially when you're with the oldies who are singing you the songs for that site you're sitting on or standing on or walking across, you know, and that you said, this one song for this place and this song is for this food, you know. Yeah.
And did you remember stuff?
No, I was reintroduced to all of those, but of course I remembered the taste.
Tell me what you're doing these days, Bob.
Retired and consultancy whenever need arises. We go out on weekends like on picnics, and that's when we take our young'uns out with us, and the aunties who are there are teaching, passing on the old knowledge about how to find, and they having a go at it too. You know, they're digging and for the widgety grub and for the honey ant, which is challa. You know, they're actually doing it. And the other day we were just taking some people out and there was all this honey on the trees right beside us. And I just saw it glistening as I was driving and I stopped the people in the car. And I stopped and I said, "Now here's all this honey on this mulga tree here, try it." And we was just licking all this honey off these branches of the mulga trees. You know, they're still there. All these things are still there. And I just had a feed of widgety grub 3 days ago. And he got some, and we guys wanted the visitors to try it out. So we would have liked to have eaten all of it, of course, but
you had to share it around.
Visitors had to share it.
It's only polite.
Yes.
Storyteller and songwriter Bob Randall, and I spoke to Bob back in 2006.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.